Good evening, and welcome to another episode of Death Mysteries. I'm your host, Kingman Bond Graham. I say evening because I only record this show at night. And I highly encourage my audience to listen to this show in the dark. Before we go into the details surrounding the Cowden family disappearance, I would like to bring your attention to a couple of more modern cases. These two lovely ladies disappeared from my area around Grants Pass over the last couple of months. The first missing person I would like to call your attention to is Angela Slover, who goes by Angie. She is 35 years old. She is 5'6", has brown hair, brown eyes. And actually, I looked at her Facebook page. Her hair might be kind of reddish brown. She looks like a really sweet person. Her family would really like to know about her whereabouts, whether or not she left on her own or if something more nefarious happened. She was last seen at the Dollar General store on Williams Highway. And if you have any information regarding Angie Slover's disappearance, if you've seen her, know anything, please call the Grants Pass Public Safety Department at 541-450-6260. Second missing person in the Grants Pass area that I would like to call your attention to is Fauna Frey. She's been missing since June 28th of 2020. She is a white female. She has blonde hair, blue eyes. She's 45 years old. She is approximately 5'6" tall and weighs about 150 pounds. This is a developing case, and details have been released kind of in a floodgate recently, and there's been a lot of speculation over the internet. So we're just going to go over a couple of concrete facts on the timeline to give you a better idea of when and how and where Fauna went missing. We know that Fauna left her home in Dexter, which is outside the Eugene Springfield metropolitan area, on June 27th and arrived in the Grants Pass area on June 28th. She had discovered her brother dead from a heart attack unexpectedly a few days beforehand. Fauna checked into the Super 8 Motel in Grants Pass. After checking into the hotel, we know that she visited Fred Meyer and is seen on surveillance video there buying some food, some shampoo, conditioner, and a couple of cans of Foster's beer. The next day, Fauna was captured on surveillance video leaving her room at the Super 8 Motel at about 8:30 in the morning. Just before noon, Fauna withdrew $200 cash from the Umpqua Bank in Rogue River, which is really close to us. Fauna was then captured on surveillance video at the Big Five in Grants Pass, where she purchased some exercise clothing, some new shoes, and a 3-pack of flashlights. Fauna then made a reservation for the Wikisu Inn, which is actually just down the road from us on Highway 99, but she never showed up to claim her room. This was June 29th, and Fauna was not seen or heard from since. Then suddenly, last week, her car was found parked in a remote stretch of wilderness on Reuben Mountain Road in the unincorporated community of Galice. This is an area with a lot of caves, a lot of abandoned mine shafts, and a lot of cliffs that are 100, 200 feet tall. It's really treacherous, and the search parties have had little luck so far because the terrain is so difficult. If you have any information about Fauna Frey's whereabouts, call the Josephine County Sheriff's Office at 541-474-5123. And now time for tonight's main story, which is the historic Cowden family disappearance in 1974. On Friday, August 30th, the beginning of the Labor Day weekend, Richard and Belinda Cowden packed up their 1956 Ford pickup truck with camping supplies. They gathered up their 5-year-old son, David, and their 5-month-old baby girl, Melissa. And they also brought along their basset hound named Droopy. They drove out to the Carberry Creek campground, which is still there today. In my research for this case, we actually drove out to the Carberry Creek campground and hung out there for quite a while, kind of getting a feel for the case and the place where the Cowdens were last seen. We spent about 3 days there, traveling around, looking at the area, retracing their footsteps, and really getting an idea of the search area and the vastness of the wilderness where these people disappeared, or were disappeared. Carberry Creek Campground is actually at the edge of what's now known as Applegate Lake, but back in 1974, Applegate Lake didn't exist. There was a valley there and a little town called Copper, which was named for the mines in the area that were, guess what, copper mines. If you travel around this area today, you can still see remnants of the mining operation, and this will come back into play later on in our story. Copper straddles the border area between Oregon and California. Carberry Creek Campground itself is less than a mile from the border, but you'd never know there's a border there because it is national forest, and there's no sign that says entering California or entering Oregon in that area. You can just drive around on dirt roads and go in and out of the two states at your whim. To get a better feel of what the town of Copper was like back before it was flooded in 1980, Mel and I traveled to the Southern Oregon Historical Society, and we looked at photographs taken of the town of Copper before it was flooded and put at the bottom of the lake. The last known location where the Cowden family was seen was actually at the Copper General Store, which doesn't exist anymore. And we wanted to get a feeling for just how far away the General Store may have been from the Carberry Creek campground. That would have been the path that David and Richard took with Droopy after they purchased a quart of milk on their way back to the campground. That was the last time they were ever seen by anybody but their killers. We know that the Cowdens spent 2 nights at Carberry Creek Campground, enjoying themselves, making s'mores, swimming in Carberry Creek, just really having a good family time. We know they weren't alone in the campground. It was Labor Day weekend, after all. There was a lot of people in the area. I mean, as many people as could be in Southern Oregon, remote forest area in 1974, but they definitely weren't alone. So this case is curious because we have no witnesses to their abduction. And if there are witnesses, they definitely never came forward to talk to law enforcement. The community was very, very willing to help out. The search party for the Cowdens was vast, and it involved the Oregon State Police, the Jackson County Sheriff's Office, the Josephine County Sheriff's Office, and the FBI almost got involved. Remember how I said that the campground and the town of Copper were right on the California-Oregon border? Well, local law enforcement tried to get the FBI involved, but the FBI declined because they said that there was no evidence that the Cowdens were taken across state lines. And I would think today their close proximity to the state line might actually change the FBI's opinion about whether or not to get involved. At least I hope it would. What we do know about the case is Belinda's mom actually lived in the town of Copper, and she was supposed to meet the family for dinner that night with the owner of the general store, the same general store, the Copper General Store, where David and Richard went to purchase milk that morning, September 1st, which would have been Sunday. So they went down to the store, they purchased some milk, they left baby Melissa and Melinda at the campground by themselves. We don't know what happened when they got back to the campground, but when Belinda's mother came to investigate with Guy Watkins, the owner of the Copper General Store, all they found was the carton of milk, or probably a bottle of milk back then, half full on the table. They found Richard's wallet and wristwatch, and there was still money in the wallet on the ground. The baby bag was also there. Some cold dishwater was on the ground in a dish pan. And we know that Belinda's purse was on the table, and Belinda's cigarettes were on the table. And if you're a smoker or know any smokers, how many of them would leave without their cigarettes? I don't know any that would leave without their cigarettes. But the most important thing that was still left behind was their 1956 Ford pickup truck. The keys were actually still on the table as well, so they had vanished. And Droopy was nowhere to be seen at this time. He would actually show up the next day during the search at the Copper General Store. It was said that he popped up in the morning and he was scratching at the general store. And since Belinda's mom and the store owner knew the Cowden family, that would have been a safe place for Droopy to run back to after his people, well, were kidnapped. I would like to say that law enforcement sprang into action on that Sunday evening and immediately started searching for the family, but they didn't. They waited till Monday morning to begin an official search. And maybe things were a little bit different back in the 70s. They weren't that different. Law enforcement today would have been probably pulling out all stops to find the missing family as soon as it was noticed that they were missing, especially when all of their possessions were left at the campground. But one reason cited for their lack of immediate action was that there was no signs of a violent struggle. There was no signs that anything nefarious had happened to the family. Well, I would say that all their possessions being left behind and their lack of showing up for their dinner date at the town of Copper, their lack of being there in their pickup truck sitting there, I mean, that is a sign to me that something really bad has happened. And I think law enforcement knows that there is no time to waste these days. I know that it used to be 24 hours before you started looking for a missing person. Well, I know today, whether it's an adult or a child, they start looking immediately if there's any hint that they didn't disappear on their own free will. We'll never know if the Cowden family could have been saved had the search began that very night. It's doubtful. But what we do know is that the search began in earnest that next morning on September 2nd. The Oregon State Police investigation, headed up by Lieutenant Mark Kazar, in conjunction with the Jackson and Josephine County Sheriff's Departments, employed about 150 civilian volunteers and the Explorer Scouts from the Boy Scouts, and the U.S. Forest Service also chipped in. We know that they actually flew aircraft with the surveillance aircraft with infrared equipment was used later on to look for the family. We know that they had search dogs. We know that they actually put, thousands of man hours into this, and they couldn't locate the family. And this search went on, I think, for about 6 weeks before it was kind of called off and things went a little bit quieter and fall turned into winter. One really uncanny thing, actually really unsettling thing about the search is that the location where the Cowden family was eventually discovered was searched during that initial push to find the family. What my theory is that the family was taken somewhere else and then later returned to the forest. I think they were held captive. And the place I think they were held captive is nearby. And I believe that they were held captive by multiple individuals, not just one. And I believe that they may have been tortured and then returned to the woods sometime later to the location where their bodies were found. Through our research in this case, and through the help of the Southern Oregon Historical Society, we read a bunch of newspaper articles and we figured out where the location was that the Cowdens were finally discovered. And we traveled there. And if you want to see video and pictures of this location, it's available on YouTube at Death Mysteries. The video is about 14 minutes long and it chronicles our quest from looking at the lake where the town of Copper used to be, looking and documenting the Carberry Creek campground, and also the murder cave, or the site where the Cowdens were finally discovered. The site that was initially searched, and the Cowdens weren't there, at least in the first couple of weeks after they disappeared. Ultimately, 7 months after their disappearance on April 12th and April 13th of 1975, the Cowden family was discovered about 7 miles from the Carberry Creek campground. They were murdered by a monster, or, like I said earlier, monsters. I think there was multiple people involved. And I'm going to go through a list of possible suspects, and I'm going to eliminate each and every one until we land on who everybody believes is the most likely suspect. And then I'm going to add on two more co-conspirators, co-monsters that I believe are responsible for the deaths of the Cowden family. So on Death Mysteries, we generally focus on the mystery and not the death. And I'm not going to go into the gory graphic details too much, but I will say that the monster or monsters responsible for this crime, I'm just going to come out and say it, they smashed a 5-month-old baby girl's head and they shot her 5-year-old brother and they shot her parents to death. And I don't know what horrors befell them before they were murdered, but I'm sure that it would make all of us have nightmares if we truly knew. And I know the reason that we all like to listen to true crime is so that we can get into the head of serial killers, into the heads of people that do these monstrous, disgusting acts on their fellow man. And I would like to say that these kind of acts, they're human, but they're also inhuman. And they've been happening throughout all of human history. They're happening right now, and they're going to happen in the future. There's really no understanding it. But I would like to say that we can learn how to not be a victim by listening to true crime, by paying attention to our surroundings. They call it situational awareness. By being good to our neighbors, by getting to know our neighbors, by getting to recognize our surroundings. You know, if we know our neighbors, it's much less likely that we will fall victim to a crime like this, and that our neighbors and our friends and our loved ones will fall victim to a crime like this. And that's enough preaching from me on this subject, but I think I've given you a little bit of insight into my motivation for creating Death Mysteries. the next segment in this recording, I'm going to go through all of the suspects in the case, starting from the least likely to the most likely. As the snow melted in the Siskiyou Mountains, the Cowden family was discovered in a remote location by a couple of gold prospectors that were camping in the area. They went up a game trail and they found Richard's body first. The next day, the bodies of Belinda and her two children were discovered hidden away in a cave nearby. The first suspect that was floated by authorities, the first person they considered could have done this, was actually Richard himself. And they thought maybe this could have been a murder-suicide, because this does happen. It happens all too often. I'm sure you've heard of it in the news. He was tied to a tree, and he was tied to a tree by somebody else. There was no weapon located. Richard was a loving family man, and he didn't do this. The police thought about this probably for a split second, and they ruled him out. One more thing that makes this impossible is that their truck was still back at the campground. There's no way the family got from the Carberry Creek campground to the location where they were found on foot. The second suspect that the police initially considered was Richard Cowden's father, Robert Cowden. He committed suicide in December, about 3 months after the disappearance of the Cowden family, but 4 months before their bodies were located. Richard's brother, Terrell, had died a few years earlier, and I think that has something to do with his suicide. Anybody would be despondent losing two sons, their daughter-in-law, and their grandchildren. We do know that Richard's sister survived and went on to serve on the city council and ultimately as mayor of Eagle Point. I wasn't able to talk to her for this podcast, but we did hear, we did see some comments from her on social media regarding this case, and we hope she's doing well today. And there is a way to move on after tragedy. The 1970s was a time when fear of motorcycle gangs ran rampant in the media, in movies, and in small town America. There was a motorcycle gang camped nearby that weekend, and suspicion fell upon them early on, but Lieutenant Mark Kazar ruled them out during his initial investigation, and I would like to say this is a pretty far-fetched idea, so I don't think a motorcycle gang did this. The next far-fetched suspect that was floated by the media early on is the serial killer Ted Bundy. We know that he was murdering at the same time as the Cowdens disappeared in the state of Oregon and Washington. The MO of Bundy it's a little different. You know, he stalked people in the urban zones. He did not stalk people, as far as we know, out in the national forest. We know that he's stuck nearby to town, so his MO does not match up. We also know that there's absolutely no connection through physical evidence. And so the idea that Ted Bundy would have done this, well, it's ridiculous, but the media seized upon this early on. Another idea that was floated by some local people was that the Cowdens were murdered as part of a satanic ritual. We know that the satanic panic really took hold in the 1980s, but the idea of ritual sacrifice and Satanism has deep roots in our society, and it was definitely something that was on people's minds in the 1970s. There was no evidence that this was a ritual sacrifice, apart from that we know that ritual sacrifices and Satanism often involve young children. So that would be the common thread that might make this a little bit plausible, but I really don't think Satanist killed the Cowden family. Another fact that caught our eye early on while reading about the Cowden family disappearance was that young David did not have the last name Cowden. His last name was Phillips. And it turns out that Belinda, before she married Richard, was actually married to a Dennis Phillips, who was young David's father. And I believe that he was investigated early on, probably not very much. I believe he was a grieving father and he had nothing to do with the disappearance. But it's always worth looking into those closest to the murder victims, including ex-husbands, ex-wives. We know that that Dennis Phillips is alive today, and he went on to have other children and to probably to mourn his son and his ex-wife and the deaths of the Cowdens for the remainder of his years. And we can only wish him well. No investigation would be complete without considering every family member. So what about Ruth Grayson, Belinda's mother? We know that she discovered the campsite with the Cowdens' belongings, and we know that she was there with Guy Watkins, the owner of the Copper General store. And I don't think that Ruth Grayson or Guy Watkins had anything to do with the disappearance of the Cowdens, even though Guy Watkins was the last person known to see them alive, and Belinda was a close family member, they had nothing to do with it. But it's always worth looking into even unlikely suspects, and I'm sure the police did so and knew very early on that these were good people desperately wanting to find their friends and family members. So now we've worked all the way up to our last and final suspect, a man named Dwayne Lee Little. Remember earlier I said that there was actually multiple people involved? We're going to get to that later, but I don't think Dwayne Lee Little acted alone. And first we're going to go into a little bit of history about Dwayne Lee Little. The first two red flags that come to mind are actually Dwayne Lee Little's name. How many Dwaynes and Waynes do we know that are serial killers? The guy's name was Dwayne. His middle name was Lee. How many serial killers have the middle name Lee? More than a couple. The first serial killer that comes to mind is actually Dwayne Lee Harris, who was active in Seattle. There was also Jesse Lee Cooks, who was active killing people in 1973-1974, so he would have been a contemporary of Dwayne Lee Little. There was Daniel Lee Corwin, who killed some women in Texas in the 80s. There was Dwayne Earl Pope. There was Dwayne Owen. Let's not forget how close the name Dwayne and Wayne are, and we all know about John Wayne Gacy. So anyway, if you're going to name your kid, don't name him Dwayne Lee or Wayne Lee or any combination of that, because they might turn out to be a serial killer. And if your neighbor is named Dwayne Lee, make sure you return his tools. Okay, so back to our prime suspect, the guy that everybody thinks is responsible for this crime. Dwayne Lee Little was actually seen in the Copper area on Labor Day weekend, 1974. We actually have physical evidence that he and his parents signed in to a cabin's guest book in the area on that weekend. We know that Dwayne Lee Little was living in the community of Rouge, which is nearby, about 20 miles away from Carberry Creek Campground. Dwayne Lee Little had been paroled from the Oregon State Penitentiary just a few months before the Cowdens disappeared, and he had returned to his family home in Rouge. And we know that he was a local, so he would have known the remote woods, he would have known all the back roads, he would have known of areas like the abandoned mine shaft slash cave where the bodies were ultimately discovered. He would have been the kind of person that could have intimate knowledge of the forest and been able to get around those woods and transport living or dead people. Now, I just mentioned that Dwayne Lee Little was out on parole. Why was he on parole? Well, it turns out that when Dwayne Lee Little was 16 years old, he kidnapped, raped, and murdered a 16-year-old girl. And he didn't just kidnap, rape, and murder her. He raped her dead body. So we know that he was a necrophiliac. And when I talk about the kind of sick monster that could kill two little children and their parents, that kind of sick monster is the same kind of sick monster who could kill a 16-year-old girl and rape her corpse. I'm sorry to get so graphic, but it's true. After the Cowdens disappeared, we know that Dwayne Lee Little was seen with a Marlin Model 60 22 rifle, the same exact kind of rifle that was used as the murder weapon. We know that his mother, Margaret, had actually purchased a Marlin Model 60 shortly before the murders, and Dwayne had possession of this rifle. We know that a follower spring from the tube magazine to this rifle was actually discovered in their house while they were executing a search warrant, but the rifle has never been located. Without that vital piece of physical evidence, the grand jury did not indict Dwayne Lee Little. But wait, there's more. In Christmas of 1974, Dwayne Lee Little had a girlfriend. Yeah, I know, this monster had a girlfriend. And she actually saw him with the rifle and turned him in to his parole officer. So they must not have been getting along that well. So it turns out that the Oregon State Police, Lieutenant Kazar, who was in charge of the investigation, he went to Dwayne Lee Little and he said, "Take a polygraph and I will not press charges on the firearms charge and return you to prison." Dwayne Lee Little flat out said, "No, I will not take a polygraph test." And as I said in my first podcast, Oregon loves polygraph tests. They give them to people on probation. They give them to people on parole. They give them to people who are accused of domestic violence. They love using that tool. Despite the fact that it's not admissible in court, it is a very useful law enforcement tool. After refusing to take the polygraph test, Dwayne Lee Little was returned to the Oregon State Penitentiary up in Salem for just a couple of years. Now, he already got out way too early. He only served 8 years for raping and killing Orla Faye Phipps when he was 16 and when she was 16. And even though he was a juvenile, I think this shows that he was already a monster in the making. Dwayne Lee Little was only returned to the state penitentiary for 2 more years on this parole violation, and he was freed once again in 1977. We don't know exactly what he did between 1977 and 1980, but we do know in 1980, he kidnapped a hitchhiker up in the Portland area. He took her to the roadside, an interchange between two freeways, I-5 and I think it was 205, and he raped her, he slashed her up, he tried to kill her, and he left her in some bushes. He actually thought she was dead, but she wasn't. And she was able to testify against him in a trial, and he received 3 life sentences. And what makes this even crazier is that his last and final victim was pregnant. And thank God that her will to live allowed her baby and her to survive and to testify and to put this monster away before he could hurt anybody else. While serving his sentence at the Oregon State Penitentiary, Dwayne Lee Little actually hatched a plan with some other inmates, and they were going to break out of prison. Well, Dwayne made the mistake of confiding in his cellmate, who was named Floyd Forsberg, about the plan to escape, and he also reportedly told Floyd Forsberg that he had indeed murdered the Cowden family. Now, he would never make an official statement, and there was no physical evidence to link him to the crime. Remember I said they could never find that Marlin Model 60 to do any ballistics on, and the grand jury failed to indict him because of the lack of physical evidence. Is that the end of the story? Well, I kind of think that Dwayne Lee Little did not act alone, and I think that maybe he had help from some close friends or maybe even family members. I'm not going to name anybody because I don't want to get myself in trouble. In particular, because I believe that at least one of those people is still alive today, and it is unfair to name somebody. And, you know, you can get sued for libel, so we won't go there, right? I didn't do all of the research on this case by myself. I would love to thank my beautiful, lovely partner in life and partner in crime, Melinda. She really helped me out with the research about the genealogy, all the players involved, and she actually came up with a bunch of really interesting facts about Duane Lee Little. I have listened to enough true crime podcasts and done enough research to know that head injuries often play a role in the creation of psychopathic murderers, serial killers, spree killers. And it is known that Duane Lee Little actually suffered a head injury when he was a child. He was hit in the head with a baseball bat and was forced to wear a helmet while his skull was being reconstructed. And I believe that this head injury probably caused him to develop some murderous instincts. This is well documented in the scientific community that head injuries, traumatic brain injuries, are a contributing factor to a lack of empathy and a drive to kill other human beings. A little more background on Duane Lee Little. His father was actually convicted of murder in 1961. He was found guilty of shooting Duane's uncle Lee after Duane's uncle Lee shot him in the junk, blowing off part of his penis, one of his testicles, and leaving him with a permanent limp. Instead of going to prison, Duane's father, Bruce, was actually sentenced to time in a mental institution. This was 1961. Now, 2 years later, he walked away from that mental institution and managed to stay out of custody until 1988. And it's important to remember that Bruce, Duane's dad, was actually with him, and Duane was living with Bruce at the time of the murders. We've actually found that murder seems to run in families, and criminal behavior is learned and taught through different generations. And if you look at human history, a lot of people aren't inherently bad, but things like head injuries and being taught that human life is not valuable from your parents or grandparents, these things go a long way in creating a monster. It was quite the adventure to go out and check out the Carberry Creek campground and the abandoned mine / cave where the Cowden family was ultimately discovered. This was a learning experience, and it also, I've never been this close to a crime before. Not a crime like this. I've never walked in the victim's shoes. I've never gone to places where people were murdered and tried to get a feel for exactly what happened. It's something that I'm going to be doing again. Pretty much every one of our episodes is going to fold in internet research as well as real life research. We're going to go out there and we're going to see exactly where these crimes happened, and I don't know if we're going to be able to get to the bottom of any of it, but it definitely humanizes what these people went through. And it was, I really don't have words to describe the experience, but I will be repeating it. This was worthwhile, and I really hope you enjoyed listening to episode 2 of Death Mysteries, The Cowden Family Disappearance. I'm really looking forward to putting together a third podcast, and I will start working on that immediately. This has been a lot of fun, and I hope to get a lot better at editing, researching, and just the whole process, because this is definitely one of the most productive things I think I've done in a long time. So let's not forget about Fauna Frey. Her case is still active. People are looking for her right now. And let's not forget about Angela Slover. She's been missing for a little over a week now. People are still looking for her. These are new cases, and they're just as fascinating as the old cases. And if there's any updates in either Angela or Fauna's disappearance, I hope they're found soon. I will update it on my next podcast. I'm going to be dropping these every Wednesday. That's my goal. It takes a lot of work, a lot of hours, so I'm going to try to meet those goals. And this is dedicated to our sheep Spooky, who passed away earlier this year. But we do have her daughter, and her daughter's name is Wednesday. And so that's how we chose to drop our episodes on Wednesday. It's in honor of our sheep. It's been a lot of fun talking to you guys. I really appreciate you hanging out for the entire 41 minutes of this episode. It's 1:30 in the morning. I think I'm gonna get some sleep. Until next time, stay spooky.